Welcome to Lingthusiasm, a podcast that's enthusiastic about linguistics. I'm Gretchen McCulloch.
And I'm Lauren Gawne, and in this Patreon bonus episode, we get enthusiastic about updates and 2023 plans.
We're also sharing one of our favorite ever linguistics papers.
But first, even though we always share on Patreon when there are episodes and bonus episodes, we also share news and updates on a variety of social media channels, including our new Mastodon account.
So you can follow Lingthusiasm as ever on Twitter, Facebook, Instagram, Tumblr, and now also Mastodon. Links to that will be in the description if you'd like to do that.
You can also just stay up to date on Patreon or on the Patreon Discord for Lingthusiasm.
Or if you want to get even more emails from Lingthusiasm, you can also get an email newsletter once a month when there's a new main episode out.
When I was a kid, my mum introduced us to doing dinner time conversation, Gretchen, by playing a game that was very transparently titled Best and Worst.
This sounds fun.
The rules of which were to share the best thing that happened in your day and the worst thing that happened in your day, which now I look back was absolutely just her teaching us a conversational frame for giving kind of more open-ended answers to questions about how your day went.
I feel like this may have been very helpful for me as a kid because I used to get asked sometimes, how was your day? And I knew that just saying good was not actually the desired answer, but I didn't actually know what I was supposed to answer if not just good.
Mm.
So having a frame that was more like, tell us about something that was good, tell us about something that wasn't as good, might have made those conversations make more sense to me.
So what was the best thing that happened for 2022 for you?
I think the best thing was that I got to come to Australia and see you.
That is the correct answer.
What do I say if I don't say that answer? And also do a bunch of other travel on the way. So I got to see some linguists in Singapore and New Zealand and just chat with lots of interesting people. So nobody gets to feel left out about this. But it was great to kind of get on the road again and see people.
Okay, I will absolutely quiz you in a moment about your linguistic impressions of Singapore and New Zealand.
Mm-hmm.
And we also have some exciting episodes you've recorded that we might have a chat about while you were on the road. And what's been the worst thing?
I mean, I think this is sort of feels a bit silly to complain about now, but I did have to cancel some travel plans at the beginning of the year, which I was excited about at the time. So I'm less, you know, sad about that than I was at the time because I've done a pretty good amount of travel in the latter even three quarters of the year. But at the beginning, it was really seeming sort of dicey whether I'd managed to travel at all.
I think, you know, probably a feeling a lot of people have had things kind of all a bit all over the place still and a bit uncertain.
Yeah, absolutely. What was your best thing that happened to 2022? Hint.
My best thing was you visiting.
No pressure.
It's been so nice to catch up and we have been doing a lot of planning that we'll chat about. And it has been great to kind of use you as an excuse to hang out with lots of other linguists. We went to the Australian Linguistics Society conference together.
That was really fun.
That was really nice.
And what was your worst thing?
I think by far, so kind of towards the end of 2022, Barbara Kelly died very suddenly. I have mentioned Barb from time to time on the show, perhaps a bit obliquely, but she was the undergraduate lecturer who got me into gesture studies and then encouraged me to stick around and do honours. And she's the person who I returned to do my PhD with and so got me also into studying Tibeto-Burman languages and working in Nepal. And so she was quite young still. I thought we had, you know, many years of collaborations ahead of us. It was a very kind of sudden and surprising thing that happened. And, you know, she's made a big, big impression on my life. And that's been kind of something to really have to deal with over the last couple of months.
That's really rough to hear about. I mean, I know I've met Barb. I hung out with Barb just like a week before this happened. And it was such a surprise, I think, to everybody, and especially to lose your supervisor who had been such an important academic mentor to you.
Yeah, and to have that kind of, you know, go from being completely overawed by her to then getting to be a student with her and then become a colleague and a collaborator has been an amazing part of my journey as a linguist. And, you know, she was interested in, I think she was just interested in people, right? Mm. She always just managed to like walk straight into making friends with people and always had like the best anecdotes. And was, you know, researching across so many different areas. I think my very general interests as a linguist make more sense if you know them in the context of Barb and her work. So my aim is to just kind of continue to do the kind of fun, interesting interdisciplinary work that she was so great at doing, and continue to use some of her fairly ridiculous anecdotes from time to time. I'm sure Barb stories will come up on the show in the future as well.
Maybe we can link to one of our favorite Barb papers in the description or something like that if people want to check it out.
But let's return to lovely things that happened in 2022. Mostly, I want to hear about your time in Singapore and New Zealand, because we've talked on the show before about your experiences of Australian English.
Right, yeah. Like, this was a return for me to Australia. I'd been there before, and so I had sort of a few general impressions. I think I got a little bit better at saying, how you going, instead of how are you doing?
Excellent.
And saying hiya, which I associate with Australian English, even though maybe you picked it up in the UK.
Yes, as an informal passing by, hiya.
Yeah. So I sort of felt like I got a little bit more comfortable mm-hmm. with parts of that, but it wasn't so much a novelty as a return. And then Singapore and New Zealand just have really interesting linguistic things going on in both of those places.
So you started in Singapore, which is a place I lived for a year. So I was very jealous of all the food you were eating.
So Singapore is famous, I think, justifiably so, for Singlish, which is from Singapore English. And it's certainly a variety that has a lot of English in it, but also has bits from the other languages of Singapore, including Chinese and Malay and Tamil, which are the three big languages in addition to English of Singapore, and sort of has all of these influences and some words that are not necessarily obviously influenced by one of those languages in particular, but are nonetheless very characteristically Singaporean.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't think there are very many people who speak all four of them, but there are a lot of people who speak sort of two out of those four, English plus one of these other official mother tongues. But then there are also sort of interactions beyond that. So the English gets influenced by these other three languages and by the context being there. I think for me, the most interesting thing was seeing all the Malay influence mm-hmm. because there are a lot of Chinese immigrants, diaspora, Indian diaspora in North America, in Canada, which I'm used to, but I'm not as used to Malaysian food or the Malay language, and it's sort of easy for me to look at and try to pronounce because it's written in the Roman alphabet. And so that was sort of an exciting part for me, because the diaspora parts from Chinese and Indian stuff felt fairly familiar, even though I've actually never been to those countries, just because of how much of that there is also in Canada.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas I don't think there's a ton of Malay immigrants in Canada, so that was sort of newer and more interesting to me to see as well.
Excellent. Yeah, and I really enjoy in Singapore how much people interact across these different linguistic and cultural groups. And so Singaporeans proudly will take you to their favorite Malaysian place and their favorite Chinese hawker food and then their favorite Tamil restaurant. And you also get this across the languages as well, where, as you said, most people are multilingual across two of these languages, sometimes more. And it creates this really fun and dynamic place to be.
Yeah, and just really interesting reading signs in multiple languages and talking with taxi drivers and things like that about what's going on, as well as students and linguists and stuff who are around.
And a really government-driven policy, right? So it's very visible on all the signage that these four languages are the four official languages of the country.
Right, and like they're often in sort of the same order, which is something I'm kind of used to from Canada, of having the sort of government-mandated bilingualism or multilingualism, which specifies an order and specifies exactly how the multilingualism needs to be carried out.
Mm-hmm.
And this is an interesting contrast to New Zealand, which has a lot of Maori on signs, but in a way that feels sort of more ad hoc.
Okay.
Because sometimes the signs will have sort of English and Maori together. Maori, of course, is the indigenous language of New Zealand, but they can be sort of in either order. Sometimes they'll put the Maori first, sometimes they'll put the English first. And then sometimes they'll have just the title be translated and the, you know, sort of paragraph of text. Say you have like an interpretive panel about like, here's what this building is or here's what this tree is. Sometimes they'll have the interpretive text just be in English, even though the title was bilingual. Sometimes they'll have the interpretive text both in English and in Maori. And there isn't necessarily a consistent order that those are in.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas in Canada and also in Singapore, there was a sort of very consistent ordering and very consistent mandates around if you're going to have something be bilingual or multilingual in this sort of official state-sponsored context, you have to do it in a sort of prescribed way. And there is a ton of Maori in New Zealand, which is also really interesting and something that I think has been increasing a lot in the last 20 years, according to what people said when I was there. But it seems to be doing it in a way that's a bunch of individual people making individual decisions about how to put the Maori in places where there had been only English in a way that's less standardized.
I do feel, as an Australian, I have to admit, I'm a little bit jealous of New Zealand, and I know a lot of Australians are, because it's a country that is small enough and has enough linguistic coherence that there can be official languages of English, Maori, and New Zealand Sign Language as the three official languages of the country. Whereas, you know, in Australia, we have over 250 Indigenous languages. Fewer than 20 of those are really actively spoken in communities now. It makes it much harder to come up with a single coherent policy around multilingualism that recognizes the original linguistic diversity. And I know the situation isn't necessarily that straightforward in New Zealand, but it's always like looking at someone else's context. You're always a bit like, oh, that looks so cool how they get to have so much visibility for that Indigenous language.
Yeah, like it's really interesting to be on something like Air New Zealand and see that like the screen on the back of the seat in front of you, you can switch the language option to Maori.
Yeah.
And that's not something that I've seen for any Indigenous language in Canada where you have that level of visibility in like a private company that's, I don't think, mandated to do that. But you can just access the airplane in-flight entertainment video in Maori as an interface language. Like in Canada as well, there are lots of Indigenous languages. Sometimes you see them on signs in various places, depending on the local context.
Mm-hmm.
I think definitely when I was growing up in Nova Scotia, there wasn't a ton of Mi'kmaq on signs, but like there is a fair bit now when I go back and I see more of it. So that's kind of something that's also changed, but not nearly to the degree that there is in New Zealand. And it sort of reminded me of when I was a few years ago in Hawaii, where there's also sort of a fair bit of Hawaiian on official signage and things like that,
mm-hmm.
which are both, you know, Pacific languages that are related to each other and sort of have a not dissimilar cultural context with respect to English and their sort of being one language of the islands and sort of having a very active revitalization effort and a lot of efforts to bring it more to the sort of public discourse state. So it was interesting to see it sort of more grassroots multilingualism compared to the official thing. Although there's also, I think, quite a lot of official support for Maori. There's, you know, radio stations and like the Prime Minister has promised to raise her daughter speaking Maori and these sorts of things that are also at a relatively official level.
It's just always interesting to see how multilingualism, both in terms of official multilingualism and how people live multilingualism, really do differ so much across different countries.
Yeah. And I think it's, you know, easy to look at New Zealand and be like, wow, they're doing all this stuff with the Maori language. And I don't know if that always translates to Maori people themselves necessarily having prominent public positions, because it could be easy to be like, oh, one quick fix for colonialism will enroll all of the white people in a Maori class. And that's not actually that simple. But it was definitely an interesting way of approaching the sort of colonial state question of what kind of relationship are you having with Indigenous people to be like, this is a very, very prominent thing in the forefront. And like, I had a, you know, several cab drivers who were telling me things, you know, new names of places in Maori. And I just don't think that that's something you would get in Canada.
And in terms of New Zealand English, the main thing that distinguishes Australian and New Zealand varieties of English are vowels. And New Zealand has kind of moved their vowels around in the vowel space a little bit from Australian English. Did you get your ear in for that distinction?
Yeah. I mean, I sort of got my ear into that the last time I was in Australia because I was exposed to Australians for a month. And before I went to that trip, I was like, you know, have a bit of difficulty distinguishing Australian English and New Zealand English. Mm-hmm. Like they say they're different, but I'm not sure. And then after a month of listening to Australians, I ran into a Kiwi and I was like, whoa, this is incredibly different. How did I ever think these were the same? So being there was definitely like, oh, I'm getting a lot of exposure to this. And the vowel system is really different. So the classic example, I think, is fish and chips, which is pronounced more like fush and chups.
Mm-hmm.
And so that vowel is a bit different. And then the other vowel that changes is the vowel that's in a word like let or get. And that becomes more like lit or git. So I'm sure I can't do an actual Kiwi accent, but it definitely feels like something I'm more confident about identifying at this point and sort of understanding because I had a lot of exposure to it.
And you can hear how things are moving around because that e in fish is no longer in that space. So that e in get can move up into that and become git.
Yeah. I will say that, you know, if anybody wants to try to listen to some New Zealand English, I was well prepared from having watched quite a few episodes of Taskmaster New Zealand, which is a fun sort of game quiz comedy show. if you want to get exposed to some New Zealand English and watch a fun show that's on YouTube.
Excellent. Entertainment, both linguistic and non-linguistic at the same time.
Exactly. It's always fun to watch TV shows in other languages and hear about them. I don't know if I have a good recommendation for getting some exposure to Singapore English. If somebody has a YouTube channel or something to recommend, let us know. So what else have you been up to in 2022 apart from hosting me and touring me around?
I've not been traveling, but in a way that I've actually enjoyed. It hasn't been a like, we're all stuck at home. It's like, I'm at home by choice. And that's been really nice to really get stuck into some work and laying some foundations for some work that has taken me a couple of years. It turns out raising a child like takes a lot of work and makes it hard to kind of
that's pretty true.
Start new projects. So starting new projects, but also finishing some old ones. And I think probably the biggest thing that I wrapped up this year was after about 7 or 8 years finishing the linguistics job interview series that I run on the Superlinguo blog.
That's been such a great series over the years. I know I was the one who egged you on to start it in the first place. So I'll take credit for everything you've done since then.
You can absolutely take credit for convincing me to start it. And, you know, I'm in a very different spot now to where I was when I did start it, when I was genuinely unsure of what I wanted to do with my linguistics training and wasn't sure if it was going to allow me to stay in academia. That's really changed. I'm really grateful this year. Marty Tatui-Billens, who also does some research work for us on Lingthusiasm, came on board to help me edit the final year of the interview series, and that's been really great working with her on 12 really compelling and diverse interviews to wrap things up.
It's been such a joy watching that interview series over its time, and I, you know, have read them all. And, you know, you ask people who have linguistics jobs outside academia whether they've had like one linguistics class ever, they've done a linguistics bachelor's mm-hmm. degree, a master's degree, a PhD, any sort of level of linguistics training and any sort of type of job. And there are definitely some themes that sort of recur in terms of common job areas that people go into, things like tech or like language related jobs, translation, interpretation, speech pathology, things like that. But there are also some really unexpected jobs that I wouldn't have thought of having any connection to linguistics, where people find these sorts of interesting job paths and, you know, use the skills that they accumulated over their whole lives, some of which were from linguistics classes and some of which were from other areas, and have really interesting reflective thoughts to say. So obviously the whole series still exists as an mm-hmm. archive. If you're someone who is feeling angst about what you might want to do with a linguistics degree, it still exists and people can use it as a valuable and active resource, which we'll link to in the show notes, and people can still read it. But after how many interviews?
I think we made it just past 80.
That's very impressive. I think that's still a really great resource and doesn't mean that you have to keep adding to it indefinitely.
No, and we have a resource guide to help with some structured activities that you, Gretchen, have helped me very kindly put together.
Yes, I have.
And I've been working on a paper that kind of summarizes the key insights that people have shared through the interviews that will hopefully be out in 2023. And I've also shared a how to do your own interview if you want to interview people for your own career aspirations and interests, or if you would like to share your own experiences and publish them on your own social media.
That's also really helpful. I think that something that people don't necessarily realize if you're looking at the beginning of the job market is that you can reach out to contacts and acquaintances and ask them about their jobs and see if what they're doing is something that might interest you. This is called an informational interview, and people are generally fairly receptive to it.
And if reaching out to people isn't your thing, there are, of course, the 80 plus interviews there for you to read.
Thank you again for trying to solve your own problem, which was angst about the job market, by creating this incredibly helpful resource for everybody else to read on the internet. So that's an ending. What about beginnings? Let's talk about our plans for 2023.
For sure. I, despite having pointed out that having a child can be a slightly distracting thing, I'm having a second child. We are recording this slightly before it comes out in February. By the time this episode is out, I'll hopefully have had a second child.
I mean, your longitudinal language acquisition experiment really needed a control group to really make sure that the results were statistically valid. So I support this addition to your continued experiments.
Just to be very clear, I am raising this one as well. I'm not sending it away so that we have a complete control situation.
Okay. Reasonable.
I just need to make it very clear.
I'm pleased to report that the first child is indeed talking now. So I think so far the experiment has been a success.
Mm-hmm. I'm very grateful to be in a job and a country where I actually am just going to take all of 2023 out from academic teaching and research, and that's going to be really lovely. But we are going to figure out some ways to make sure the podcast keeps ticking along across the year.
And one of the benefits of me being in Australia in 22 was we were able to get a bit of a head start on recording some episodes and interviews for 2023. So everything should be ticking along as planned, though you may see a few more very exciting interviews in your feed than in a typical year.
Yeah, I'm very excited for some new guests, perhaps sharing some insights from some of the places Gretchen has visited. But I'm also excited for some potential Lingthusiasm return guests as well.
We're very excited to be bringing back to you Kirby Conrad, who was the interviewee for a very popular episode about the grammar of singular they a couple years ago. They'll be taking your questions about language and gender, queer linguistics. Feel free to contribute anecdotes about how people are queering language in various languages and contexts. And we're really excited to be talking in the Discord again with Kirby Conrad.
The live show will be on the Lingthusiasm Patreon Discord on the 18th or 19th of February, depending on your time zone, which is coming up very soon. If you're listening to this after those dates, it will pop up as a bonus episode in a couple of months' time.
If you're not sure you're going to be able to make the specific time, you can also share questions, anecdotes, comments in the replies on this post or in the AMA questions channel in the Lingthusiasm Discord. And we'll start with questions that people have submitted in advance and then move into a general discussion period during the episode, which is what we did for our live show about the linguistics of swearing last year. And I think it worked really well.
Mm-hmm. And just to be very upfront, I'll be away trying to keep a tiny human alive. So it'll be Gretchen hosting this one. I will hopefully be able to pop into the Discord and say hello at least.
But yeah, small humans are, you know, notoriously fickle. So we will let Lauren attempt to get some sleep while she's being very sleep deprived.
Too kind.
And, you know, keep up with pre-recorded episodes with Lauren at other times.
Our live show is part of Lingfest 23. Which is a series of rolling events by linguistics podcasters and other linguistics groups. We'll link to the Lingfest website as well. That's following on from Lingcom 23, which is the International Conference on Linguistics Communication, which was started in 2021, and we're very excited it's back for 2023.
We're participating in Lingfest, which is an event for anybody who's enthusiastic about linguistics. If you're somebody who's a linguistics communicator, whether that's you're someone who specializes in communication, like a journalist or a podcaster who likes to touch on linguistics topics, or whether you're somebody who's a practicing linguist who also does things to do with interfacing with the public, we're encouraging people from both of those streams to come do more crossover with each other at Lingcom 23.
Gretchen, I know this episode has been very temporally relevant to the start of 2023, and we normally try and make our episodes a little bit more listen at any time. So in the spirit of giving people something they can drop in and listen to at any time, we both thought as a bit of kind of start of year cheer, we'd share one of our favorite ever linguistics articles.
I think this is also very relevant to the theme of updates, because mm-hmm. this is a linguistics paper that is about a very particular kind of Christmas letter, you know, those sort of annual updates letters that people sometimes send at the end of the year that's like, you know, here's what we've been doing, the sort of best and worst, if you will, of the past year that people send out. And this is a linguist who decided to play a bit of a experiment on her friends. So a linguist named Ann Cutler did a very particular type of Christmas letter that she sent out to her friends to see if they'd notice it. They did not. And then also wrote a paper to see if people would notice this phenomenon. So we definitely don't normally do this, but this is really something that you want to read this 4-page paper, which I promise is very accessible, before getting spoiled on what it's about, because you have the opportunity to see if you notice anything strange about this paper if you read it yourself by eye before continuing listening.
We have a downloadable, accessible PDF of it. It is a paper called The Perception of Rhythm in Language from Cognition in 1994.
I promise it's less dry than that. It's only 4 pages long. If you don't want to be spoiled for an academic paper, which I promise is possible in this case, please feel free to click pause now and click on this paper and go read it.
I'm delighted to correct you. It's actually 3 pages.
Ah, sorry. Go read this 3-page paper. It's really fast. And if you haven't, or if you're returning, this is now the spoiler zone.
If you haven't had a chance to read it, maybe I'll just kind of read the opening couple of sentences to give you an idea of the content.
Sure.
Section 1, the segmentation problem. The orthography of English has a very simple basis for establishing where words in written texts begin and end. Both before and also after every word are empty spaces, and this demarcation surely helps the reader comprehend. In a spoken text, however, as presented to the hearer, such explicit segment cues are rarely to be found. Little pauses after every single word might make things clearer, but the input is continuous, a running stream of sound.
This implies that part of listening involves an operation whereby input is segmented to be processed word by word, for we cannot hold in memory each total collocation as most sentences we come across are previously unheard. Yet we listeners experience no sense of some dramatic art of separating input into pieces that are known. As we listen to an utterance, it seems unproblematic. Words and sentences seem just as clear as words that stand alone. Just how listeners accomplish such an effortless division is a question that psychologists have now begun to solve. This paper will describe, although with minimal precision, some experimental studies showing what it might involve.
I love that you can't help but fall into, when you say it aloud, the fact that this entire article is actually written in rhyming verse, but I made it to the very last paragraph before realizing this.
And like, it's not only written in rhyme, but it is written in meter. And the meter is impeccable. And I'm someone who has a really huge admiration for good scansion. The meter is impeccable and it's got this sort of rhythm. And yet, when you're reading it by eye, most people don't notice. I think I got to like the top of the third page. I wasn't quite at the bottom before I noticed. And the paper itself is about how you don't notice this. I love it so much.
It's incredibly meta and incredibly well written.
Yeah. And she mentions in this paper that she sent it out in a Christmas letter to like 100 people, friends and family, who didn't notice that there was anything strange about the letter at all. And that was sort of her naturalistic experiment because, you know, what self-respecting linguist doesn't occasionally use their friends and family for, you know, trivial, harmless linguistic experiment like this? I sympathize. And like nobody called her on it. And this came to my attention because actually, very sadly, she died at the beginning of 2022 and people were saying, you know, posting various kinds of tributes. And someone said, well, you know, this is the paper that I always think of Ann Cutler from, which is this incredibly epic, tightly written paper entirely in verse demonstrating this phenomena that's this self-referential paper.
Mm-hmm.
And so I came across this paper in the context of someone's memorial of her. And that it mentioned this Christmas letter and that it doesn't reproduce the Christmas letter. And I thought, well, you know, she just died, but people have got to still be around who got that letter. Surely we're in a window where we could track the letter down and read it, because now I'm really curious.
And did you manage to track down the Christmas letter?
Yeah. So with the help of a linguist named Gareth Roberts, who noticed that one of the other linguists mentioned in the paper was Bob Ladd, who's a linguist who's still around and active.
Mm-hmm.
And so he emailed Bob and said, hey, do you happen to have this letter? And Bob talked with Ann Cutler's husband, Bill, and got his permission to post it because he's also mentioned in the letter. And then Gareth has put it online with permission. And so you can now also read the Christmas letter.
Amazing.
Which I will read the first couple sentences of. So you can also get the feeling for that. But if you want to pause and not get spoiled, go read it in your head first.
Once again, I love that we've never done one spoiler and now we're giving people two.
Two spoilers. And there's a note from Bob Ladd at the top of the thing that he posts that Anne was known among her friends and colleagues for her imaginative Christmas letters, which were never merely these sort of newsy letters that were common in the 80s. One year would be a poem, one year was a quiz, one year was the map of all the flights they'd taken. So this is both the background to the first sentence of the letter that I'm about to read, and also explains why Bob had saved so many of her letters over the years. And also, I think, means that she was sort of expecting her friends among all people to be able to notice if there was something amiss because she'd done all these weird letters over the years.
In fact, she really does draw a lot of attention to it at the start, because the first line, if you've returned from reading or you're ready to be spoiled, with apologies to everyone, our annual Christmas letter is an ordinary looking one in 1989. It's not what you'd expect. That's perhaps so much the better, since this year has contradicted every previous design.
First consider how in other years we've moaned about the weather. Well, complaints about this summer would be very hard to make. The temperature was perfect and the sun shone. Altogether, it was necessary to pinch oneself to prove one was awake.
It's so impressive that when you do read it out loud, you're struck by some very interesting turns of phrase to get the meter and the rhyme to work. But when you're reading something with your eyes, you don't really take that into account.
It really, really doesn't. And this one says, our annual Christmas letter is an ordinary looking one in 1989. Like, she's giving you this big clue that maybe there's something not ordinary happening. I love the last paragraph as well, which is, we wish you all the happiest of holidays this season and a splendid 1990. Come and see us if you can. May your dreams, but not your nightmares, all be granted within reason, and your plans take off on time. With all best wishes, Bill and Anne. So even the signature rhymes. Oh.
Also, a really lovely sentiment to leave the letter and maybe this episode on.
May your dreams, but not your nightmares, all be granted within reason, and your planes take off on time. Stay lingthusiastic. We're going to work on the scansion.
We'd have to rearrange the rhyme, but we'll keep the sentiment. For more Lingthusiasm and links to everything mentioned in this episode, go to patreon.com/lingthusiasm. I tweet and blog as Superlinguo.
I can be found as @GretchenAMcSee on Twitter. My blog is allthingslinguistic.com, and my book is Because Internet. Lingthusiasm is created and produced by Gretchen McCulloch and Lauren Gaughan. Our senior producer is Claire Gaughan. Our production editor is Sarah Dopierala. Our production assistant is Martha Sutsui Billens. Our music is Ancient City by The Triangles.
Thanks so much for being a patron.
Stay Lingthusiastic!